In the story of Jacob, his two wives were Rachel and Leah. Then he had two handmaids, Bilhah and Zilpah. If you are going to use this story of Jacob to establish the biblical position on polygamy, how would you use the story? Welcome to Probe. We continue our series on beginnings and belongings, conversations in the book of Genesis. My partners again are Paul Dibdahl, Larry Vavirka from the School of Theology. And that's the question I want you men to start with. How would you use this story to describe the biblical position on polygamy?
I would probably initially sidestep this story as the defining point for the biblical position on polygamy and move to the story, the creation story, where you have God creating a helpmeet for Adam from a rib, and suggests that God didn't take out two ribs and create two women, but just used one and created one woman. There, that would probably be the starting point. The Jacob story is it's a real zoo when it comes to the complications of multiple marriage. But again, you could look at this story and say, well, the moral of this story is don't marry two sisters. You know, I mean, if you're going to have more than one, get them from different families so they could at least be friends and not the sort of antagonistic stuff that you see going on here. And but then it's complicated by their bringing forward their own servants and offering them as partners. And then things begin to multiply, as well as this sort of chaos that begins to then erupt and reign, which I don't know. I haven't made a study of polygamy that much to know that this is sort of what happens in every instance. I would just guess that it's a characteristic in some ways, but you certainly have that going on here.
Paul, do you have any comments? I think the biblical illustration of, well, Hannah and Penina would be another example where you have multiple wives, and these weren't sisters. and that was not a happy home either. The point I wanted to make in raising this question is that often you can't simply go to a single biblical narrative and use that, especially if it's a historical narrative, as the standard for what's right and wrong. Mm-hmm. There tends to be an ordering of things. As you suggested, Larry, we go back to the original story. And the way these narratives read, you often get the nasty stuff just by reading the story. What a bad experience it was, simply for these things to happen. And it was so bad that they began naming their children after the status of the debate. One of those little kids was named Victory Over My Sister. Can you imagine the chaos in a family where, hey, come here, Victory Over My Sister? It's just really catastrophic.
And yet even today, of course, children are drawn into family disputes and in similar ways.
Who are quite frequently the pawns of the conflict.
Yes. Right. Yeah. And it's surprising in a situation like this, though, that you have some amazing ways that the biblical laws begin to clarify the issue. Exodus 21 says, when you have a second wife, be sure you treat the first one fairly. If you don't give her food, clothing, and marital rights, she shall go free for nothing. That is a principle of fairness there, which I think would help a great deal in some of our tussles today on what constitutes right for remarriage.
And it's interesting, too, in that it assumes polygamy.
Yes. Yeah.
So
the ideal, that going back to Genesis 1, of where you have one husband, one wife, that is a marvelous ideal. And, of course, that's reaffirmed in the New Testament. And if you want some good illustrations of how bad things can get, just read the story of Jacob. Now, another question raised by this section of text is the way Jacob and Laban played with each other, seen who could cheat the other the most or the best. It is amazing how this tends to run in the family. You have Rebecca cheating Isaac. You have Jacob cheating Laban. You have Laban cheating Jacob. It's just a family trait, see. But what's intriguing here is they had this agreement that the spotted and striped ones would go to Jacob, the solid color ones would go to Laban. And so Jacob takes birch branches, I think it was, and made stripes in them, laid them in front of the ewes when they were conceiving, and presto, here you get, as a result of those striped stakes, you get striped offspring. Now, I'd like to use this as a springboard for how God works within a scientific worldview.
Yeah, well, back to what he was trying to do, which is actually was studied seriously in the early years of conditioning, and studying conditioning by in the field of psychology, as well as some interest in genetics as well, is using the environment to control the outcome of the reproduction of particular animals. And these were some of the early experiments that were done in Russia as well. So, I mean, it's had its modern exploration with at least a theoretical look at it. Of course, the work with peas by the famous geneticists has sort of set all these things aside. We have the dominant and recessive genes, you know, controlling most of this rather than birch branches. But, it is fascinating. It is a fascinating belief that, I mean, he's picking up. I'd be curious to know where that came from, because it obviously had some sort of credibility in the popular mind of the day that you could affect the genetic outcome of your animals or crops or whatever, but animals here in this instance, by controlling the breeding environment. And
now, what would you say, based on your knowledge of modern psychology, Larry, about the possibility of that having a solid basis in science?
Well, I'm a firm believer in the placebo effect. I'm not so sure that would be operating here with animals. But a lot of things happen based on the depth of conviction and belief that you give it. And sugar pills can be efficacious at times, if you believe in them strong enough. Now, can you believe that your animals are going to produce a certain kind of stripe here and have that happen? Can you have that kind of effect over your environment? And I would really question that.
The point that I want to get at here is that we tend to worship science. And so we tend to make everything in Scripture science, when there's a lot of stuff in Scripture that's not science. But again, I would not rule out, in fact, I would affirm the fact that God takes whatever people's convictions are, works within those convictions, and accomplishes. It's a little bit like C.S. Lewis said, it doesn't make any difference whether you believe there is a devil who can do all kinds of nasty stuff, or you disbelieve in the devil completely. Either of those extremes will get you ultimately in the same place. See? But if you really believe that the devils are there, he will play with that, with all kinds of superstition. And he'll use a different method for those people who don't believe that there is a Satan at all. So I would want to argue here that God works within this framework. But I would not want to argue that because God blessed it, therefore we can go out and use the striped stakes to get children today.
Well, and that's interesting. So what do we believe that we then have God bless, that's not necessarily scientific, but culturally defined by our superstition or our expectations? I mean, how often will God do this sort of thing defy good science, for example, in order to bless Jacob or whoever the Jacob is?
Mm-hmm.
modern times.
Of course, I would want to come back to that question and say that probably the real mark of our commitment to God is a willingness to worship Him and be faithful to Him, apart from any blessing of our flocks. Anything else? In other words, this is the story of Job.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Philip Yancey's book, Disappointed with God, I think is a good illustration of that. He studied Scripture and was astonished to discover that the time of high miracle incident comes at a time of spiritual weakness. Elijah, Elisha, and during the Exodus. See? And my favorite quote here from C.S. Lewis is one from Screwtape Letters, where Screwtape says to Wormwood, "Do not be deceived, Wormwood. Our cause is never more in danger than when a human being, no longer desiring, but still intending to do our enemy's will, looks round on a universe from which all trace of him seems to have vanished, asks why he has been forsaken, and still obeys."
Scott, I remember being in a Sabbath school class where a dear brother, his complaint was that God miraculously sustained the Israelites in the wilderness, allowing the or keeping the soles on their shoes, for example, for years without them wearing out. And the tires on his car were wearing out, and his clothing was getting ragged, and he was wondering why in the world God wasn't blessing him in the same way when he was being as faithful as he could be and returning to the Lord his due and so on. So what you're saying is that man may be closer to the kingdom than he actually realizes, because he's in his dire distress, and yet he's still talking about God even in the absence of...
Well, I would want him to accept the fact that he needs to trust God, but would not be expecting God to provide necessarily all these bits and pieces. Now, I would want to be able to thank the Lord for whatever he does for me. And I think he gives us marvelous gifts. But for me to make my commitment to him dependent upon receiving those gifts, I think can be dangerous in the end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. True.
Now, there's one more narrative here, and unfortunately we're running out of time, but it's one of the most powerful ones. It's the story of Jacob's wrestling with the angel.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just urge you to go back and read that, absorb at the end of chapter 32. One of the most astonishing things there is Jacob's statement when he gets through. He puts God in a hammerlock and says, "I will not let you go until you bless me." And then he escapes. And his statement as he leaves is, he called the place Peniel, because I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved. He knew the rules, that we shouldn't have to look, we shouldn't be able to see God, but in this case, he had seen God face to face and is still alive. Well, next week, we continue on the story of Jacob, and Paul and Larry will be my conversation partners again. My thanks to Susan Michael, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. For Probe, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194 or email us at probe@wwc.edu. Thanks for listening. We'll be here next week at this time with Probe.